tell us.
Yes.
If that's up, dimming this helps me.
This is the option we, otherwise we strain to see the screen.
Yeah, that's better.
Do you have any reading glasses?
Mine, have you under contract yet?
But did you do that? Still looks yellow to me. I was like, I drive here by your house all the time, it's yellow.
I'm gonna go with like a
Okay, testing, testing.
Is the house central gray?
He just painted it last year.
It'll be a nice thing. We've got all the trees around there too, so.
Yeah. We're live.
Good evening and welcome. My name is John Davidoff, I serve as the chair. Today we have in attendance Commissioners Barksdale, Lang, Hillhorst, and myself. Commissioners Carlson, Walter, and Morris are excused. So we'll get going. Do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes, we have the agenda. Any commissioners have any communications to share across the... No? Any community council representation? I don't see any, so... Otherwise, I'll move on to you, Mr. Fellow, staff reports then.
Thank you, Chair and Planning Commissioners. I do not have anything to report.
Very good. Well, thank you. So we'll move on then to... that's a pretty quick walkthrough up to public comment. I think we have two members signed up this evening. First up, we have Mr. Phil McBride.
Great. Actually, I'm going to pass out some of my my comments so you can have some of the... Right. Thank you very much for letting me have a few moments. I've actually been involved. I think you've seen me here a few times.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, sorry. Phil McBride, representing property on Main Street, 11040 Main Street, the General Scott Building. So I've been here a few times. I've never been as civically active in my life as I have through this whole process. So I'm kind of in awe. Frankly, the dedication of the people, both the staff and the volunteers, is kind of a really interesting process to see what's going on. And frankly, the transparency of everybody's intentions, right? I mean, you know why we're here, I know why you're there. And the integrity of the process is pretty amazing. So thank you very much. I've learned a lot. Some of the things I've learned, all known to you, so just bear with me a second. The Bellevue Zone hasn't changed in 35 years. Major changes. I assume there's been tweaks along the way, but it's a zone of zoning that's been around for a while. The original zone had the wedding cake concept, and we still have those overlay districts around. The original zone never anticipated light rail coming through. Sound Transit's bringing light rail into Bellevue at a cost of $3.7 billion to the taxpayers. Of taxpayer dollars. Sound Transit and the taxpayers need transit-oriented development. They need to bring ridership to the rail stations. They need to create transitions from the rail stations to the surrounding job centers and residences in Bellevue. In general, they need to respond. They need transit-oriented development to respond to the proximity of the rail station and the walk shed. The park lid that's going to be over the rail station and the East Main Station will create a buffer zone for the neighborhoods that wasn't there before. It's something new. There's no transit-oriented development overlay in the zoning. You'll see that when it comes up from the Urban Land Institute Technology Assistance Group, they're going to show that there's no, and I think you guys know that. The CAC, I know there was a downtown CAC and a south CAC. It feels like our property's kind of got lost in the mix. So the CAC on the south and east side of Main Street, you know, really addressed the light rail station. Ours doesn't seem to really take it into account. The cost of a through-block connector, which is the property that we're, or the project that we're proposing, is expensive to build. And we're providing an amenity of walkability to the city that I think everybody in the city council and here wants to see happen. And we want to build a project that's forward-looking and aspirational, that's also in alignment with the city's intentions for the whole zoning change. We spoke to Sound Transit before this meeting. They may or may not attend. I'm not sure if they will. But they gave us some of the comments that I talked about when I talked about what they were hoping would happen around transit-oriented development around the station. So it wasn't just something we made up. So we've got an ask. You know, how can the Planning Commission help? We like the way our project vision embraces transit-oriented role. We like the front door to East Main. But the current coding in front of you today has obstacles that will prevent what we have planned from becoming a reality. We would ask that you ask the staff to create new development standards that would allow FAR averaging between A3 and B3. Transit-oriented development is best when it's mixed-use and vibrant, and to that end, keep the FAR independent of uses in that area. We've got a little use problem that you guys can get into the details with. So it's kind of support for our ask. You're going to see it in a little while. The Urban Land Institute Technical Assistance Panel on page 17 actually talks about the rail station and says zoning for station area, usually a quarter mile radius modified by topography and natural boundaries, like I-405, should respond to the station area rather than historical zoning boundaries. And so we would like you to consider that, think about it. Matt is going to step up here in a second and give you a little bit more details and a little more visuals of what we're talking about. We'll talk about the quarter mile overlay. So with that, I thank you very much and appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir.
Next up, we have Mr. Metro.
Thank you, Planning Commission, for having me. My name is Matt Rowe. I'm an architect and planner with Baia Architecture. I'm here on behalf of Phil's project, as well as BDR's project on the corner of 112th and Main. We've got a little map up here to show you. It's a great marriage between two property owners trying to do a really exemplary TOD in close proximity to the East Main Light Rail Station. So we've drawn on here that quarter mile radius that helps determine ridership. And as you can see, a good chunk of it is over the Surrey Downs neighborhood, which has a difficulty accessing the station. They have kind of to go around it up to Main Street. And then a big chunk is over on 405. So there's a few properties that can really leverage that transit investment. We're one of them, as well as the Red Lion Inn and the Sheraton. Because they're all in close proximity to the station as well. So, and just to reference, the City Hall light rail station, we're almost within that quarter mile, certainly within the half mile. And here's an overlay of our property on the zoning maps you've been looking at over the last 6 months or so, with the perimeter districts, the overlay of the B3 and the BA, and the proximity of the light rail station. And so you can see that's kind of the historic boundary of downtown, without regard to the light rail station. It was established quite a long time ago. And so we're only 600 feet from that station, and there's this new park that's being constructed now where the tunnel is going underground. Creates a really nice buffer to Surrey Downs from our project. And if you look at this diagram, you can see that what we're trying to do is create a really nice desire line through our property to bring people into downtown and where all this new burgeoning development, everything in that light blue color is potential development that would be enabled by the new zoning. And also of note is the First Congregational Church right behind the John L. Scott property has a reciprocal agreement between each property to allow access. So there's a natural point of access between those properties already, and we're leveraging that as well. And I'd also like to say the Red Lion and Sheraton sites, we're supportive of them being redeveloped. We like the CAC, Surrey Downs, recommendation for upzoning those areas well, because we think they can be completely symbiotic and add the vibrancy and the front door of downtown Bellevue in this location. So here's our what we'd like to do. Take it one more step further. It's kind of hard to see, but that the ghosted area is the quarter mile, and we're definitely within it. But there's so much of it over the Surrey Downs area, there's not much to touch. This is kind of looking through our project, where you find that through block crossing kind of transcends through it, but we have to go up a 55-foot grade chain, so we're going to have to bring in public elevators and lots of retail. It all culminates itself down in the corner of Main and 112 in this nice entry plaza with outdoor cafes, a gracious Hilltime court with more retail above, and again the accessible elevators to bring people up through the site and into the rest of downtown. So all that stuff is part of the CAC's goals and policies in the city for public amenities. Really difficult to do. Great to do it here with two different property owners that we can phase and do this together. It is exemplary urban design and TOD, and we're only using 60% of the site instead of the maximum 75. So the alternative to this is doing a 5/2 apartment building. And that is what the current zoning, if we took it literally, would encourage us to do, because it requires that we have residential use out on Main Street. We'd like to do office use at a very small boutique scale. So you can see here, that's the difference. And doing a development like this also is very internal looking, where many of the apartments are living in very small courtyards. So it isn't a desired outcome. It doesn't have public benefits, and as many public benefits, and it certainly doesn't have the three-block crossing. And it's difficult for us to actually get to 5 FAR on this site with that type of construction. So what we'd like to do is to put all the height over on the site, the B3, which allows the 230 feet, and they keep everything low on the A3 side. And the difference being is the current zoning doesn't allow us to put office on the Main Street side. Well, office is a good use on this side because that's a traffic busy arterial, and it allows daytime, nighttime uses and more of a mixing. And so this is and also more solar access into the mid-block crossing. So how can you guys help us? We're asking you to work closely with city staff to create new development standards that allow the FAR to be averaged across our whole site between the A3 and the B3 rather than segregated, and then be able to apply the FAR independent of use, so more of a form-based code outcome. And so that's pretty much what I had to say. Appreciate your time, and we're happy to leave this presentation with you, and we're continuing to work with staff. They've been great, and as we proceed with this, we make it a better project. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, please.
Okay. Sure. Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Roy, so the issue here basically where the zoning boundary is drawn, and is that what's creating the problem here?
Yeah.
Because you probably are aware, but we as a commission have dealt with, we'll call it, other split zoned parcels, and did some cleanup at least along the south boundary. And so could you talk a little bit about that split zone issue, and then talk about, and just for us, so we have an understanding, what is it in the city code that says that you couldn't, if you have this split zone, that you couldn't share the FAR across the site? Where in the city code does it say that?
Well, it's the proposed code. And right now it says that on the A3 overlay, which is the left side here, 150 feet, that the FAR is limited for commercial to 1.0, and that on the other side, it can be quite more, but we don't want to do it that way. So it's just a matter of, they've segregated the use, the designated FAR by use on one side, or on both sides, so that they can't be traded and swapped, at least the way we'd like to do it.
Okay, and this is in the draft code,
yes.
Just to make sure I understand. Okay. So I only bring this up because my recollection from the CAC, which I spent a few years on that three-hour tour, was that the CAC uniformly recommended getting rid of the differential between commercial and residential FAR, and what some people have affectionately or unaffectionately termed the commercial penalty throughout downtown. The BDA has made a recommendation for at least 18 years the BDA has said get rid of that distinction. So, all right, thank you. That's helpful.
Okay, thank you.
So we had two sign-ups on the sheet. If there's somebody else who would like to, otherwise we'll keep moving on. Oh, yes, please.
Sure. Potatoes, commissioners, my name is Carl Vanderup. My address is 9103rd Avenue Northeast. I'm here to point out in your guys' packet a letter that I prepared for the ULI panel members this last week. And I'll let you guys read that in your own time. But I wanted to draw your attention to a comment that I made towards the end of this about how this incentive zoning system, as staff has pointed out in their memo cover sheet, is missing looking at affordable housing, which is, I think, a very important piece to what it means to talk about livability. Perhaps nothing is more important to most people than their ability to afford to live where they want livability, right? So the panel, the ULI panel, also pointed this out, as you'll hear later again from staff. I think it's on page 8 of their slides, or page 16 of the slides, page 8 of the worksheet here. But they suggest that concurrent rollout of affordable housing and incentive zoning would reduce developer uncertainty and enhance effectiveness of both programs. To be calibrating the system and the points and the FARs and all this stuff and leave affordable housing out on the side, to me, is an extreme injustice to those that are proponents of affordable housing, like myself. I think that this all needs to be calibrated together and at the same time, or else somewhere later down the road, 6 months' time, 1 year, 2 years, after we wrapped up for the livability initiative, somebody's going to come in and say, oh, yeah, let's talk about getting affordable housing as an amenity. And then it'll either take away from all the other amenities that we're talking about today, like artwork and you know, who knows what, or just completely not be utilized, because it's going to be cheaper to provide artwork on the street than it will be affordable housing. Kevin Wallace today attended the ULI panel debriefing and made some poignant comments about how the multifamily tax exemption and the 1.0 FAR exemption for affordable housing are intended to be and should work together to make affordable housing achievable by developers here where rents are so expensive. So I think these are important points to pay attention to, I don't know how we get them back into the fold at this point, but I'm pretty sure that initiative can start with you guys requesting it. So appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so moving on, we have next up session on livability. I think I'll give it to you, Mr. Cullen, to give us some context and take it on this whole place.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Davidis. This session is on downtown livability. It's the continuing review of the draft downtown land use code amendment. is programmed for 90 minutes. There's three topical areas that are going to be discussed. The first one, about 15 minutes long, is the East Main Station area interface with downtown livability. Second one, for 25 minutes, is the incentive zoning update, the ULI panel findings and recommendations, and approximately 50 minutes of discussion draft land use code to continue to review to prep for eventual public hearing. And we have several staff here tonight that are going to be participating in this discussion.
So as thank you for having us here again, Planning Commission, Chair Valdez, and members of the Commission. As Terry noted, we have three discrete segments that we're going to go over tonight, so we'll have a few other staff join us as well. So we'll start out with myself and Neil King on the downtown livability team. Trish Byers and the co-development manager for our effort. And then Michael Cotterman, who's in Department of Planning and Community Development, senior planner who worked significantly on the East Main Station area, so that's why he's here as part of this agenda. So we wanted to start off with the East Main Station area plan and its interface with downtown livability. It was brought up on January 11th that you were interested in kind of having a refresher on how that CAC process turned out, and also by implication how it kind of syncs up with the portion of downtown that's directly adjacent to it. So tonight we're going to start off with Michael doing a brief overview of some of the land use and urban design aspects of the CAC work that he was in charge of for East Main. And then I do have some supporting slides that talk about that part of downtown in the similar categories of stuff that he's going to be talking about. So with that, I'll turn it on over to Michael.
Thank you, Emil. So this is just a quick overview of the area that we're talking about. You can see the downtown area in the center of the picture. The East Main Station area is the little T to the right. I'm sorry, to the left, lower left corner there. And as Emil said, what I'm really here to talk about is the coordination between the East Main Station area plan that was done, as well as the downtown livability. This is not a briefing on the East Main Station area plan itself, which will be much more extensive, and that will come to you in the fall when we're ready to start the code work on that. So just to set the expectation, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail, nor do we have the time for that this evening, but I want to give you enough at least to help you understand what interface existed and how we did coordinate the two efforts, the timing of those as well. So just a quick refresher, this is the study area that we used for the East Main Station area, and I should have brought my pointer, but I didn't. It's not going to work on here. So you can see the station itself is located in the center there. It's the platform, the East Main Station redevelopment area that we focused on is the primary TOD and the secondary TOD, and that is east of 112th Avenue Southeast and south of Main Street. So for purposes of looking at the study area for the station, we considered the quarter mile and the half mile. We used the quarter mile. You can see the bump on the top of there. That's the quarter mile that goes into the downtown area. We used that for purposes of making sure we had connectivity between that part of the downtown and the East Main Station. We also looked at it in terms of looking for members for the CAC. So we actually have a couple of members that served that are from that area, the overall station area planning effort that we did. And then we went roughly, so the quarter mile goes down to about Southeast 6th to the south, and the half mile goes down to about Southeast 8th. The directive from the council was the redevelopment would only be for that area that would be east of 112th and south of Main. The downtown livability CAC wrapped up their work in June of 2014. The East Main CAC started their work in September of that year. So we had the preliminary proposals, at least from the downtown livability, that we used as a starting point when we were looking at how this area might be compatible with what was being considered for the downtown. Obviously, they hadn't had any decisions made at that point. So the rest of the area, pretty much, we didn't look at any land use that was already part of the downtown livability. We were not going to revisit any of that discussion. that would have been duplicative and redundant and unnecessary. So our main focus, as I said, was that area that's to the south there. The main issues that were identified through the outreach process that we did on the East Main Stationary Plan included the land use, traffic, ped bike connectivity to the station, safety, parking, noise, and then community character or aesthetics. And the last one in particular comes into play when we talk about the street frontages along 112th and along Main Street. So that's really where a lot of the interface occurs between those two. It's also interesting to point out that this is the study area, particularly the redevelopment area itself, is really uniquely situated because it's at the confluence of the downtown, the single-family residential, the office, hotel uses that are there, and I-405 and the uses to the east. But it's a unique situation, and we're really trying to come to some agreement on in the CAC with what is the unique niche that this can really serve. It's not an extension of the downtown. It's certainly more than the single family that exists. It's going to be more than what is there today. What should that look like, and how would it relate to these other uses that are surrounding it? So we started with setting some parameters of what would be considered. Oh, thank you. Some parameters of what would be considered to orient you. So here's 112 Southeast, and this is Main Street up here. So the downtown is this area over here. The station will be right along here. So again, we said, this is not going to be an extension of downtown, but we had the work that had been done on downtown livability in terms of land use. So we used that as the upper limit of what would be considered for the potential redevelopment. We were looking for a range of, that we could use for discussion purposes, to test different scenarios, as well as to do our environmental analysis on. And we used a consultant to develop these scenarios. In fact, Mr. Rowe and Via Architecture were the city's consultant in developing this. So I'm not surprised to hear that he's in support of what the CAC came up with. But we looked at a range of options here. The low end of the range was the existing zoning, which currently is office and limited business. And that FAR is 0.5. So it's very suburban in style, surface parking, low rise, low intensity development. And then we looked at a maximum of a 5.0 FAR on the site. And again, this refers to all of this area here, not just the Red Lion site, which is what this diagram is focused on, but it's really looking at everything within that quarter mile, this primary TOD. So it's the Red Lion, the Hilton, the Bellevue Club, and a couple of properties over here that are fairly constrained in terms of environmental. The secondary TOD, we did not do a whole lot of redevelopment potential there simply because they're very severe environmental constraints with wetlands, Sturgeon Creek that runs through there. So there is a little bit of potential, and the recommendation from the CAC was for a slight upzone in that. So where we ended up with the CAC in looking at how this fit in with all those different areas that I was talking about, their recommendation ended up being a 5 FAR in this area, just south of Main Street, which would essentially mirror north of Main. However, they did put a taller height limit than what is proposed for the area north of Main. They're looking at a 300-foot height limit, subject to some special provisions, conditions. So basically, to get up to the 5 and to get that additional height, there will be some additional requirements that have to be met for public benefit, that it's really a higher quality, better TOD type of development, and this is something that will get worked out through the code. But that was something that the CAC was very much in support of in their recommendation. So it's not an automatic 5. There are things that will have to be done to get there, similar to what we have in other zones like Bellevue. And as I mentioned, we looked at a couple of intermediate scenarios as well. But this is where they ended up. And again, this is just the Red Lion site that we're looking at here. You can see it's a fairly intensive development for this particular site, and that's a little over 6 acres. So in terms of some of the things that were important to the CAC as we were talking about this, the unique niche that it be something that's complementary to the community, that it would serve the residential neighborhood as well as the residential areas in the downtown, the southeast part of downtown. This is not meant to be some sort of a huge regional mall type of a situation. They don't want big box here. They want to see something that really fits in terms of the TOD. So mixed use is important. And the relationship to the area will continue to be single family in the future. We also talked about building placement, making sure that we had the taller building closer to 405 and to Main Street, and that we stepped back along 112, getting at the character of that street as well as respecting the residential that's on the west side of the street. Minimizing the wall effect along 114th, that's along the freeway, which I think is something that's also talked about in the downtown, as we talked about in the past in the downtown, so that we're not creating a canyon effect as you're going through that area. Parking that would be out of sight. By that, we meant not large surface lots. Could be structured parking, could be underground, could also be above ground if it's tucked in behind buildings, storefronts, or those types of facades, so that it's not just a parking garage along the areas that we're trying to create that pedestrian environment. Safe design, so that we have visibility. Visibility not only for this area, but also eyes on the station itself that's immediately across the street, and then lighting in public spaces. So those were some of the key things that we're looking at in terms of land use. And there's nothing in there that's incompatible with any of the adjacent downtown uses that are existing or proposed. And that was something that we looked at through this. And then in terms of character, it's really looking at drawing people into the development, the mix of uses and activities that are there, because this is serving not only the area immediately south of Main, obviously, but it's going to be serving people that are north of Main. Even though they're in the downtown, they're close to the other station, but this one is going to be closer to them in many respects, and the uses will also be closer to them. That Main Street would be a safe place for all modes, and this is where the interface with the downtown came into play again, because we had the downtown transportation plan update that was done. We brought staff that worked on that to the CAC. They did a couple of briefings so that we could talk about what was envisioned through the downtown effort, what did the CAC have in mind in terms of what would happen along Main Street. And they talked about something that, it, to the extent possible, continued some of the themes of Old Bellevue farther to the east, but also respected the fact that we have different types of land uses and different intensities of land uses on the north side of Main versus the south side of Main. So there may be some difference on the different sides of the street, but they definitely wanted it to be safe for all modes. They wanted wider sidewalks than what's there now. Sidewalks where we don't have them right now, you know, is also something we'd like to see there. And then for 112th, again, our focus was primarily south of Main Street. That would happen in front of this redevelopment area that we're talking about, but understanding that some of that could also continue north into the downtown, and that there'd be more coordination in the future as that got fleshed out. So I think those are the main things in terms of East Main. And then Camille is going to talk some more about the downtown area relative to that.
Yeah. So Chair Davidos, would you like to have me continue on with the downtown portion, or would you like to pause for any questions?
Just pause maybe some questions or comments, if you would. Just quickly on the table, please.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing this, so we can at least start getting a flavor for what the CAC is thinking, because this is going to be an extension of the downtown, right, to some extent, or at least I see it that way. It's going to be a flow into downtown from the East Main. I see conductivity. You said it's coming back to the commission in the fall for us to start doing the zoning and code changes, correct? Why so late, since the CAC finished last year, why wouldn't it maybe come right after our downtown recommendation, March, April? Why the timeline?
So before we can do the code, we have to do the policy, the comp plan changes that will be the basis for that. And we're starting that in this cycle. So those from the Planning Commission will get your direction on that. And then we can start the code work on that.
So you can't do it concurrently, you have to do it.
It's a little bit difficult to do that concurrently, because they get enmeshed, and we really need a good, pure policy discussion about what's happening with that.
And are we going to potentially recycle and reuse a lot of the TOD that we're using in Spring District, a lot of those codes, and look at what we did there and draw them in so we don't have to start from scratch completely?
Yes, and I think that would be the intent. You know, we have some things in place in other zones, but we haven't fleshed out the work program yet, so we don't know exactly what pieces we're going to use. But I think we are looking at other zones to see what we can borrow from those. There are some things about this area that will be unique and that we'll have to tailor the code to that. So we will probably, we'll probably end up with a zone that is specific to this redevelopment area, a TOD zone. But yes, I would envision that it would incorporate similar things in other intersections.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Commissioner Boston?
I said a really basic question. What's FAR averaging and how does it affect this area?
We have not looked at FAR averaging for the East Main area. We really looked at it in terms of the 5 FAR would apply immediately south of Main. The 4 FAR would apply for the rest of the area that we designated as that TOD, primary TOD area, down to 6th. And then I think we went up to a 1.25 south of 6th down to Southeast 8th. But we haven't looked at averaging for that, per se. That didn't come up.
Okay. But what does it, and what would that mean in terms of these various FARs?
For the East Main area, it would... It could affect where things are placed on the site, and that is probably a little more problematic. I can't speak to the downtown, but for the East Main, that would probably be a little bit more problematic because one of the things the CAC was very clear about is they didn't want the 5 spreading across the entire area because they wanted to keep the higher, more intense buildings north and along the freeway, in that corner area there. So, you know, we could take a look at that and see if it will make a difference, but I don't really know at this point how much more it would do.
And I can, just elaborating on the concept of FAR transfers, essentially if you want to take the development potential for one part of your property and transfer that space over to another building, being able to do that without limitation. And in essence, it would have the look and feel of a lower density or FAR building where you transferred it from to a potentially a larger, bulkier building where you've transferred it to. So that's in essence what the FAR transfer means.
Commissioner Lang, I'm going to assume you have a question or two.
No.
No?
No. I'm not doing this alone.
All right.
Miraculously, yes.
Well, thank you, Mike. We'll give it to you. I know that's you.
So this is kind of continuing the conversation down in this area, but as it relates to the work that the Planning Commission has been doing on downtown livability. So there are just a few things I wanted to highlight for the commission and public that's kind of tracking this particular part of downtown. So as you remember, our downtown CAC did basically take on the elements of stationary planning within the downtown livability work. So there's no separate station area plan per se being developed for downtown. It's integrated into our downtown work that we're doing. The CAC final report actually acknowledged that and had a number of recommendations that were permeated through the density and height discussion, through the design guide discussion, and even talked about regarding coordination with Sound Transit and parking management, for example. So we've listed out those things that the downtown CAC talked about with regards to stationary planning. And as you can see, the prime downtown station, the one right outside City Hall, its quarter mile walk shed is there in blue, and it's primarily within downtown. So we touched upon a lot of those components just within our relook at things within the downtown area. And then as Mr. Cotterman noted, the East Main one did have that portion of the yellow quarter mile radius down there where we made a concerted effort to look at land uses and connectivity down in that part of downtown Bellevue. We did focus all of our CAC effort and the commission's land use code efforts to essentially the area north and west of this, which is the downtown boundary. So that is where the downtown boundary ends, where the downtown land use code provisions apply. So this area going north. Some of the key things that I just wanted to note is when we started out with the CAC, it was in some ways fortunate for our stationary planning is that even dating back to 1981, a lot of the heights and densities and even the urban framework that was put in place 35 years ago really was supportive of transit. We can see that in the office core that developed up on 108, the iterations of the Bellevue Transit Center and the tremendous ridership that happens at that bus location. So it wasn't that we were starting from scratch from a TOD or stationary planning aspect when we were doing our downtown work. It was really picking out the things that really needed to be updated in downtown as it relates to stationary planning. So some of those that I just want to note for you, we spent a tremendous amount of time talking about the OLB zone. So that's an area that clearly, when it was first put in place, was not a transit-supportive zoning parameters or urban design elements. So we spent a significant amount of time with the CAC and the commission kind of bringing those up to be more transit supportive, and because they're right next to the two stations. We also looked quite a bit at the Civic Center, so this area that has Braeburn and City Hall and the Convention Center, and there were some modifications even to that area that we did, both from an FAR and height and urban design standpoint. Some noteworthy ones are extending the pedestrian corridor all the way down to 112, and 405 was really talked about a few years ago, even back in the CAC process, and that has kind of morphed into the Grand Connection that's a council priority. So the focus on connectivity and pedestrianism through this space has been, first and foremost in all of the discussions we've been having. Down in this area, as you know, we've talked about more density, more height down in this area. The commission's current recommendation is a 5 FAR and 230 feet in the OLB South, as we call it. And then, as you know, we've spent a number of meetings talking about refinements to our historic A and B perimeter design districts that just kind of blindly followed the edges of downtown, both with the A and the B, and looked for thoughtful refinements to those, both in the allowed FAR and density standpoint, as well as the height. So we changed from current recommendation is to go from 55 to 70 feet here for both residential and commercial buildings. 5 FAR for residential, where it's currently 3.5. And then also allowing taller heights up to 220 feet in this area right here, where currently the max would be 99 feet. So significant changes there. I also just wanted to note a lot of the other non-density and dimensional things that go into stationary planning. So just within our effort, we spent a significant amount of time with the commission in kind of the early part of 2016 talking about the building sidewalk design guidelines. So this really is how you want to focus pedestrian activity and uses along different streets. So in essence, we re-examined this whole area down here in the East Main area from what was historically an E classification, so the lowest of our kind of pedestrian activated ones, up to the second highest, which is now a commercial street. So this is part of your current code. And we also looked at the current recommendation. We also looked at all these other streets that were kind of in and around this area that's now going to have much more pedestrian activity when the stations come in line. And from just quickly on a sidewalk width, we did the similar aspect of re-examining 112 and Main Street and 110th from a pedestrian standpoint. And the current code package has 16-foot sidewalks as opposed to 12 that were historic. So I just wanted to kind of flesh out all the things that we've been looking at so you can hear it at the same time as Michael did his summary of what happened in the East Main area. So, Chair Dalbos, we're happy to entertain any other questions before we move on to the next topical area.
I'm not seeing any questions on this one, so I think we should just keep moving. Oh, please, yeah.
So, the reason for that split in along Main is because there's a neighborhood, it's to create a buffer, more of a buffer between.
Yeah, the A and B perimeter overlays are essentially overlays that do go all the way around. The A goes all the way around the north and west and south side of downtown. And it essentially is an overlay on top of the underlying zoning that looks to suppress heights and FARs because of its proximity to the perimeter areas. The CAC recommended changes to the residential building heights from 55 to 70 when the commission kind of re-examined things in the middle part of last year. You actually took that recommendation and split it up into different pieces. So you're just recapping your thoughts where that where it abutted a single family residential neighborhood, for example, up here in North Town, the majority of the commission was not comfortable going up to 70 feet and wanted to keep it at 55 feet. So that's what your current code recommendations are. In other areas, like down along here, the current recommendation is 70 feet. And this area down here, as I stated, your current recommendation is 70 feet as well. I think in that area, it was both the presence of the Portal Park that was highlighted, as well as the proximity to the station were the things that kind of triggered a 70-foot height limit down there. And then the B design district is essentially the next area in from the A that also has additional height and density provisions.
Thank you. I think we'll keep moving this again.
So with that, I'm going to excuse Mr. Cotterman from the table, and Dan, we're going to join for this part. So the next item on the agenda was an update on where we're at in the incentive zoning work. And also, earlier today, we had the ULI panel's presentation on the findings and recommendations. So we have copies of the slides that they gave us. All of you should have one. Terry has one for the file. And we also have a stack back there on the table that I think there's enough for everyone in the public to grab one of those. We'll also be posting this slideshow on our planning commission in downtown Liberty website tomorrow when it goes up. So tonight we wanted to, because we haven't really talked about this in depth for a while with the commission, we wanted to just kind of recap a couple things that the commission has talked about on this subject, and then go into a bit on the Burke economic analysis, and then we'll give you some highlights of the ULI recommendations, but we're not going to go through their full slideshow. We're going to have it as a handout, and then we'll identify some next steps on that one. So with that, we'll just jump right into things. So we do think it's important, just as we're kind of re-engaging with the commission on this subject, and our thoughts that this is going to be a kind of topic first and foremost for the next couple of meetings with the commission as we kind of work through things. People are often asking us even now why update the system. So we thought it would be wise to both acknowledge it that the original system does date back to the original code, so back to 1981. There was a need to identify it in the CAC report to really update the whole system to current market economics, and just pulling out some of the relationship to livability pieces that were identified in the CAC report. It's nice that their report does do this for all the different topical areas, so whenever we're kind of re-engaging with the commission or public, it's good to remind people about why we're even looking at this thing.
Just a quick question, if I may.
Yeah.
Did I hear you say that there were people asking why we're updating it?
People who are sometimes new to the process or haven't been engaged in it too much, and it's not unique just to this one topic. It's common with things like the building heights or design guidelines, or really any aspect of things that are in a current code. Oftentimes people who are new to it will say kind of an honest question, what's not working about it, why do we need to update it? So
just surprised.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, thank you.
So just highlighting some of these, it's really the thought about better using the amenities to reinforce neighborhood identity, really focusing on things that are most important to the city, acknowledging that there is some lift that could be gained in the incentive system through the additional height in FAR, and really opportunities to have creative design in our downtown. So these are all in the CAC report and have been shown to you before. We also wanted to just kind of highlight the steps that the commission and staff and the council and public have kind of been on relating to the incentive system. So back in the CAC process, we actually did a land use code audit for all the different elements of the downtown code, including the incentive system. So that's something that we still refer back to, and even the ULI panel examined it. There are also a full section or chapter in the CAC report just on the amenity system, and it acknowledged that there were 23 current amenities, but also they had a good list of new amenities to look at. So the CAC was really trying to look to the future, look for innovation, and trying to figure out what things would be wise to potentially implement in the future, with the proviso that there was a lot of work that the commission needed to still do to develop the system. There was also, just recapping, in spring 2015 is when the council gave the commission direction to really take on the full CAC analysis, including the amenity incentive system. So they didn't peel that out for them to look at separately, but wanted to task the commission with the review of the incentive system. And then I think all of you were on the commission when we had the joint commission council workshop back November 2015, so a little over a year ago. And shortly thereafter, we and the commission received the council principles that were to guide the effort on actually updating the system. So those were important. And then just remembering back to June of just this past year, we both went to the commission and council to go over a structure and approach for updating the system to make sure there's buy-off on what was being done to it. And the draft list of amenities are also in the current code that's out for review, just noting that in the BURP analysis. The list of amenities that are in the current code reflect both what emerged from the CAC work, but then also was refined by the commission as we've been talking about this over the past year or so. And this graphic here as well is acknowledging that the incentive zoning is a companion piece. There is some interface with other parts of the land use code, but we've spent a lot of time talking about the standards that guide downtown development, the design guidelines, which we have in the draft code, and then now we're looking at the incentive zoning system. So just a reminder about how they all fit together. Dan, do you want to take over starting from here?
Sure. Well, good evening. This is Director Dan Sparrow, Planning Director. This incentive zoning system is actually one of the more complex parts of our code, and a lot of land use codes don't have this kind of system. When we were faced with the need to update it, kind of going back to the basics, challenging it is 35 years old. It was put in place with a different set of economics for downtown. Kind of a different set at that time about understanding what we were trying to incentivize, what we were trying to achieve in downtown. We'll make downtown livability. And today, we know new things, and new things have evolved. We've got 14,000 people living in downtown Bellevue now. So I think the commission's real familiar with all that. And in fact, Chair Lang on the CAC was helping to address those issues about what should an updated incentive system really address. We're at a point where we have that list of amenities, and it comes down to what are the economics of updating the system, being very, very sensitive to how we have a legacy system that's embedded in the existing zoning, and in many ways much more complex in updating the existing system than it is to develop a new system entirely. In Bell Red, a few years ago, we were putting in place a new system that occurred with the upzone of Bell Red that occurred at that time. Here we're dealing with a legacy system that's embedded in current land values to some extent for downtown. We want to be very, very careful about trying to understand the market realities of how that works today and not having unintended consequences economically about doing this. So challenging, honestly. And we've been through one of the more kind of advanced that I know of efforts to get this right with all the work we've had with our consultant, which I'll get into in a second. But here are some of these considerations about updating an existing legacy system like this. You and the council, the CAC, all wanted to be add new amenities and be aspirational about a 21st century urban center. again, we knew we were an updating the existing system. We wanted to make sure that we were on the straight and narrow with regards to the legal requirements, and that aspect is important, obviously. We, in the framework, and you talked about this quite a bit, that there would be some new requirements in the system. Weather protection, as an example, would be shifted to a requirement under the CAC. Recommendations and draft code. And there also would be items that would no longer be incentivized. Again, this was in the approach, and what you told us back when we talked about this approach last summer was, let's take a close look at what that means when you take some of those incentives out. And the poster children for that are structured parking and residential use, which under the proposal would no longer be incentivized. The market's doing those things on its own. Another consideration is that properties are affected differently by the existing system and by the proposed new system. Market sensitivities, the need for periodic updates, so we don't find ourselves down the road 30 years from now kind of wondering how come it's been 30 years and we've never updated the system, which is where we are today. And then a final consideration to point out is the council principles for this effort do provide some real clarity. They came out of that joint council commission workshop that Camille just mentioned that happened about a year ago. So those are all key considerations in the update. Those are the council principles. We'll just project that up there. I think the just highlighting one or two of them, some of them get into the key considerations we just talked about, but important that the whole idea that the modifications don't effectively result in a down zone. So they'll talk about how we tried to really wrap our thinking around that with the economic analysis that was done, and that trying to understand what the real value of the incentives could be for those developers that then choose to use them because they're a real incentive. So those council principles are all very, very important and were kind of foundational to the work that's been moving forward. This is a point-by-point take on the approach that we took to the commission and the council last June. So we'll touch on these real briefly. Update and clarify what's a requirement versus an incentive. Emil pointed out that the incentive zoning system is part of a larger structure. So there are design guidelines, there are design standards, and then there's the incentive system. And so the whole thing needs to work together as a whole. And there needs to be clarity about what's just a straight requirement and what's really trying to be incentivized. And then adjust the basic FAR to account for anything that becomes a new requirement. Remove features that are no longer real incentives. These all relate to council principles. Creating some amount of additional lift in the system that can be incorporated in terms of really value for new public amenities. We have the FAR exemption for affordable housing as part of the proposed approach. And then what's in the real bonus FAR, the focus of that being on these livability features of placemaking and public open space and things that contribute to walkability and cultural features in the downtown. The rest of the approach covers trying to tailor the system so it helps to promote neighborhood identity and character. As downtown has matured, the CAC got quite a bit into how we now have a number of neighborhoods downtown, and the incentives and livability features can help reinforce the identity of different neighborhoods downtown. The potential for fee and loop payments as opposed to on-site performance is something that we need to look at. The idea of essentially some flexibility under a development agreement for some kind of amenity that we haven't identified but could really provide greater or equal value to what we have through the specific amenities that we've identified, so that flexibility element through a development agreement. Number nine is the idea of periodic updates to the system, so we don't get way out of base in terms of where we're at. And then the final one is some element of sustainability and green building incorporated into the system. So that was the approach that we took forward last June to the commission and the council. We were trying to make sure that we were actually hitting the mark in terms of really the theoretical approach to this before we got into the numbers. and make sure we were hitting expectations for the system and the council principles that were guiding the effort. These diagrams we found real helpful in terms of where that takes us, theoretically. And on the left, you can see the existing system. There's a pointer here. This is the existing system, the current system. And you have some level of FAR exemption that's not counted. It's for ground level retail today. And then you start measuring FAR above that. This is the system that's been in place now for 30 plus years. In each zoning district, there's a basic FAR and a basic height that's set. And then to get up to the maximum FAR and height that are also set in the current zoning, essentially you provide for the amenities that actually drive you there. Some portion of the amenities that are also counted as bonus are called basic amenity requirements, and they actually have to be provided whether or not you use the incentive zoning. So that was the structure put in place, again, 30 years ago. The proposal, and again, this is recapping what you looked at last summer.
You have to admit that's pretty funny. You have a mandatory incentive.
Well, there are mandatory livability elements back 35 years ago that were considered to be real important, but they wanted some flexibility over what you did, and they wanted to give you also credit in the incentive system for that. So I think it was, one could say it was, these are sort of standards, but they're also going to give you credit for some of your bonus requirement. Again, this is the system put in place 35 years ago. And then the proposal essentially has, as the existing system does, an exemption for, in this case, it's expanded a little bit. It includes both the existing ground level retail exemption, but also the potential exemption for affordable housing. And then your building, again, you've got, there's your old basic, and an adjustment upwards, a considerable adjustment upwards, for essentially what are currently incentives that are being taken out of the incentive system, and another adjustment upwards for new requirements that gets you to a new base. And then this model has then some amount of headroom, not clear how much that's going to be, that's what's coming out of the economic analysis, between the new base and what was the old maximum FAR. And then in some cases, not every zone, there's FAR and or height added. That's a new increment above and beyond what is available under the existing zoning, which is also under this model available in terms of the bonus. So that's the conceptual model we talked about last summer that's trying to kind of build off of the principles and the approach to updating the system. So this gets really interesting when you try to figure out what are the numbers that make sense here. What's the new base that's appropriate, given that theoretical model we just put out there? And how much would the new incentive actually be worth to develop it so that it's a real incentive? So we had a significant consultant contract on this. The firm Burke has been doing this work. It's been quite complex. What they've actually done is a pretty involved model that wound up essentially building about 582 prototypes of different, 588 development. I'll get into this in a second. But the whole effort here was to avoid cherry picking for just the best results and try to test a whole range of different assumptions. Now, what you can do on any given site is incredibly variable based on the size of the site and the developer desires within the zoning. Uses and potential density yields, the way you're going to handle parking. Many, many factors go into trying to decide what you do with a given site. And then you take that based on different sizes of sites, different zoning districts, and different uses. It gets very complicated in terms of the variables you're working with. So you need a lot of prototypes to avoid just cherry picking out what might be the best results to drive a certain outcome. So many 588 prototypes were developed and tested in order to try to test a wide range of variability across the downtown. So let me drive first. I'm going to get it back a little bit into the details, but I want to drive first to what came out of all that analysis. So this is kind of flash forwarding to conclusions from what this economic analysis what we're doing with this economic analysis and what we drove as conclusions from it. So, first off, the system resulting from that proposed approach and then the additional economic analysis that Burke has done over the ensuing months winds up proposing a system that continues to have base and maximum FARs and heights with limits set by residential and non-residential building types. So that's just like the existing code. The system as proposed now will raise the new base, the as-of-right FAR, without participating in the incentive system, to what's current 85% of what's the existing maximum FARs for each district. So that's a huge lift from what the current bases are in every zoning district. And this is, again, as you saw in that model a moment ago, this accounts for both the new requirements and the deletion of amenities that are no longer real incentives. As far as the height that goes with that, the new base as of right height would be raised also to the existing height maximum, all the way up to the existing maximum. And that's to make sure that you can use the additional FAR that's in the base. So you don't have to buy your way, quote unquote, to that new, to use that height and make sure you can use the base FAR. So for example, with the base FAR adjusted in the 01 district, that means at the base development without the incentive zoning, you can go all the way up to the 450-foot height maximum because the base, the new base was adjusted high enough, but we want to make sure you can use that. The fourth bullet says there's a few exceptions to the 85% rule for the new base FAR, and I'll get into these in a second, but it turned out that in order to make sure that we were not having unintended consequences, we actually wound up raising the base, proposing the base be lifted a little higher in a couple of cases. A very specific review results that came out of the economic analysis that said there are some cases where the new base should be raised a little higher than 85%, actually to the 90% level of the existing max. The new maximum FARs in height and maximum heights, of course, are based on the work that you've been doing, that the CAC did, that the Planning Commission's been doing, so basically wind up the new base is raised according to the economic work that's been done. And then, of course, the new maximum FARs and maximum heights are the ones we've been talking about based on the work that's been going on to date. Then there's a new, now we call this the exchange rate. Essentially, it's a dollar value for a square foot of bonus FAR. So that we call that the exchange rate. And what that means, you can convert it back into a desired amenities. So for example, if you're building a unit of open space, and that unit of open space costs $1,000 to build, at $25 a square foot, you get 40 bonus FAR points for building it. So it's that simple a conversion. What you do have to make sure is that the costs that we include in the incentive zoning system are correct. And that's work that's going on right now to take that last step. But there shouldn't be a lot of, it's a pretty transparent process. You've got the cost, $25 proposed exchange rate, and it's a simple division conversion of that into bonus FAR points. And I'll come back to this in a minute. So I'm giving you kind of the conclusions from all this economic analysis first, and I'll go back into the details a little bit. The last piece was an exchange rate for height, because in some cases we're increasing height without increasing maximum FAR. So in the 01 district, for example, proposing that height be allowed to increase from 450 to 600 feet, but no change in the FAR. And the CAC, the council, the process has always talked about valuing that, but what's that really worth? How do you put a value on that and capture some of that in terms of the incentive system? Because the idea is that additional height would be an incentive for developers that actually want to use it with some contribution towards the amenity incentive system. So there were three options in the final work that was done in the Burke work. And we were asked the ULI panel actually to give us some insight as to which of those options made the most sense. A couple other things before I move on. The commission got the Burke report on all this economic analysis about 2 weeks ago. So we sent this out to the commission at the same time we sent it out to all the other, ULI, the stakeholders, public, posted on our website. Don't know if you had a chance to read through it. I can tell you it's pretty dense reading. but I want to walk you through a few parts of it, and if you would like additional briefings on it, one-on-one or whatever, be happy to do that. Also be happy to bring in Michael Hodgins, who was the chief analyst with Burk that did this work. But I'm going to give you a few highlights of it. The other part is, and we'll get to it in a second, that the ULI peer review process that looked at this, basically with the idea of trying to get a group taking an objective look to see if this homework was done well, to be kind of cut to the chase, real fresh. That group just wrapped up their work today, made a presentation in the council chambers at 2 o'clock this afternoon. So honestly, we're still digesting that work. I'll talk about that a little bit. But so it's pretty fresh stuff as we move forward here.
If I could, sir, just maybe two quick questions on the. I was not there for the session this afternoon, but I do have two questions. One was the comments with respect to affordable housing. I was wondering if you could give some comments on that one first.
Sure.
And then secondly, there was input around the zoning for the station area, and in particular around the parking minimums.
Sure.
And so we'd love to get your perspective on that as well.
Sure. Do you want me to answer those before going on, or either way?
If you could, yeah.
Sure, okay. So I just flash back to this conceptual model of the new system and the old system. And in this conceptual model here on the right, which would be the new system, you can see what was proposed here was, what we proposed is an exemption for affordable housing. That exemption for affordable housing, just like the exemption for ground level retail, is not taken out in this system from the lift of between the new base and the maximum. There's some advantages of that because there's a limited amount of lift. The new base is raised so high that there's not as much, anywhere near as much leg room as there used to be theoretically in the old system. Now, we know that a lot of the old system, actually, that lift wasn't real, right? But when you do get it real and recalibrate it, theoretically, that distance in between the new max, the new appropriate base and the max, the old max, is not that much. So if you try to actually do affordable housing and livability elements both within that same lift, there's not a lot of currency to spend. And so this gives you a way to get some additional value for affordable housing in really another channel, if you will. Now, what ULI said is we should do a good job of making sure we look at that in an integrated way, and it would be best to have those two processes reach the finish line at the same time. The affordable housing piece is also moving forward under another channel, which is the work on an overall citywide affordable housing strategy. And so we're working on that effort as well. And the council wants to understand how what we do with affordable housing downtown affects other parts of the city and how we look at that holistically. So honestly, we're scratching our heads a little bit about how to bring these over the line at the same time. But the ULI comment on that is very understandable. And it is something we're struggling with a little bit and do need to figure out.
Thank you.
As far as the parking ratios goes, this effort did not do, generally, across the board, this downtown livability update has not done a lot on the parking front. Most of that is essentially has been retained for some future effort. Now, there's one big exception to that. The downtown livability proposal would include the ability for a developer to do a special parking study that could essentially say, we've looked at the characteristics of our project, given its proximity to whatever, its mix of uses, what we think it's actually going to generate in terms of parking demand, and we think it's different from what your numbers and your code minimums and maximums will say, and so we're proposing this departure. And here's a fact-based analysis to back that up. We would have, for the first time, the ability for that special parking study to depart from those code numbers and do something different. We heard from ULI, they were talking about that being a possibility in a different jurisdiction, and they said, gosh, you know, the way it worked, there was one of the developers on the ULI panel. He said, well, the way it worked there is we had to do all our design work, go design review, really design our project, spend a ton of money on designing our projects, and after we did all that design work, find out a long time down the road whether the city was going to accept our parking study or not. Well, that didn't work very well because you had to embed a tremendous number of assumptions about how you approach the site, how you dealt with your parking, the parking costs. So much of a project involves maximizing how you deal with parking. And so ULI said, you know, if you're going to do this, make sure that you do it at the right time in the process and provide for that parking study. So it's actually contributes to the project in the end of the day, and you have some certainty there about how it's going to happen. But it is an avenue for something like a TOD project very close to a light rail station to depart from what otherwise would be your basic standards.
That's right.
Down the road, we do plan to do a more comprehensive downtown parking study. It's real complicated stuff for a variety of reasons we can get into, but it's true that the current downtown livability work has not gone in and systematically changed minimum and maximum parking ratios across downtown.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. The kind of, so there is a bit of a chicken and egg, I think, in terms of the timing of these. But I would recommend we certainly track this and stay on top, because obviously these are the implications, whether it be parking or the housing. I'll give it to you, Commissioner Hill-Host.
Thank you. So just, it wasn't my original question, but tapping onto that, I just have a feeling that if we don't have a parking component in our downtown livability recommendation, I feel like it's not complete, because it's such a huge discussion for downtown and the changes that we're making. So I just think it's a little bit of a miss. I understand you've said multiple times it's very complex, but boy, what do we hear about? We're not even the Transportation Commission, and we hear about parking over and over again. So I think there's going to be something lost if we do end up making a recommendation without the parking component fully realized. The other thing is, in your presentation, you had said some of the amenities that used to be are now no longer going to be an amenity. My question is the development and the business community, the BDA, are they lined up that is okay to take off the amenities table, or is there any points of contention that we should be aware of?
Well, yeah, I do think it's a sensitive topic. I think there's been a fear from day one that the city would make these kinds of adjustments, which are pretty major adjustments in the incentive system, without realizing how significant that was in terms of the economics of development. And so I think that it is quite a sensitive topic, and I think the challenge is to do it in a way that's sensitive to the economics of downtown. And really does this in a way, in the council principles, it was essentially discussed as a, don't do this in a way that downzones properties. And so some of the discussion ULI today talked about the contrast. One of the developers that's active in the Seattle market was talking about the contrast between the effort that we've gone through here to try to understand how this is done in a way that's very sensitive to those existing land values and how things may be done in a different jurisdiction that wasn't. So I'd say, yes, it's a very sensitive topic. I think there is a lot of interest in updating the system, but doing it in a way that's very sensitive and thoughtful about unintended consequences, including those economic consequences. And I think the council and the commission were both very, get that feedback in the process we've had in prior engagements. So yes, it's a sensitive topic, and I think we have to approach it carefully.
Any other questions, comments? I do want to echo Commissioner Gilbert's comments around the parking. I think we all realize that would be a big miss. But I think there's a question of being pragmatic about where we are and not trying to boil the ocean versus addressing what is very clearly a priority for the people who live in the city of Bellevue. So, give it back to you.
Great, thanks. So now I'm going to take you, a moment ago we were talking about sort of the cut to the chase about what were the conclusions from this analysis. I'm going to take you just for a few minutes into a little bit of the technical detail behind the analysis that Burke did. All about evaluating the economic implications of the proposed changes. So the questions, how should you modify the base zoning and set new base FARs to reflect the changes? including what's coming out of the system that's currently in the incentive system and new requirements? And then what's the potential value of the incentive that remains? And would it be used by developers, or at least by a number of developers? Recognizing these challenges, the system has not been updated in 35 years. And there's quite a bit of variation within different zoning districts downtown. So instead, if this was successful, we would be essentially aligning the system with what is really important to livability today, the 21st century downtown, the work that came out of the CAC, while trying to avoid these unintended consequences of disrupting the market. Key tool in terms of the analysis is what's called residual land value. So this is kind of the principal tool and the outcome from testing these different prototypes. So essentially, residual land value is what you get. You take into account all the factors contributing to development costs, and those factors contributing to project value. And what you're looking for to solve for is what's the maximum amount that a developer would be willing to pay for the land. And those are at a broad level, you can see those that those factors on the left that contribute to project value, and those factors on the right that contribute to development costs. So residual land value gives you essentially a comparable output that you can compare. And you can compare that residual land value that results in looking at development in this way to existing land values. And this is what was done in the model. So in all those prototypes, those 588 prototypes that I talked about a moment ago, that came out of looking at different parcel sizes and different density yields and different ways of dealing with parking and so forth by district and by use, that residual land value was the output that allowed us to compare all those different development types. So first, the new base FAR analysis, looking at some of the key changes that you had to test for. Again, taking out the biggies in terms of what would be coming out of the incentive system, modifying for new for requirements. In the end, the new base FAR that came out of all this was, as I mentioned, the base FAR that set at about 85%, or set at 85% of the current maximum FAR. Here's the chart that kind of looks at this. Here's how to read this chart. You have, on the left, you have what's called new base low, and on the right, you have what's called new base high. If it is an open dot, if it's not shaded, it means that the residual land value meets the test of being within the market ranges of land values for that district. If it's shaded in, it does not meet the test, i.e. there's a problem for that prototype. Now, a few prototypes can fail. When a lot of prototypes fail, it's like, yeah, this is not working. So that's kind of the test in terms of looking at this. And then more looking at this, and this is a roll-up of lots of results. But here you can see essentially the variance here as you go left to right has to do with parcel size. And as you go up to down within each of these, this is actually different intensities. So you can see that's actually the key right there. It's intensities, and it has to do with the percentage of the zoning yield that you get. So this is just roll-up results on lots and lots of different prototypes that were tested. Right here you have 42 prototypes tested for non-residential uses in the downtown 01 district. And you have, within the downtown 01 district, you have 42 prototypes that were tested with different levels of parcel sizes and different levels of FAR yield for residential uses within the downtown 01 district. You're doing really well if all your prototypes work. Essentially, that means that the residual land value that comes out of the model is at least equal to the market land values. And there's a whole other part of the report that goes into how those market land values were established. There's a whole calibration exercise to all this, but I'm kind of giving you some highlights of the report here.
happy to get into more of this or do one-on-ones with this and so forth. But these are some excerpts from the BERC report that you got a couple weeks ago, which looks like this. But that's kind of how to read these kind of roll-up charts. You can see some weird anomalies here when you test these bases. When you see all these red dots, I mean, you're basically looking at a situation where none of these work. This is the old Bellevue A and the old Bellevue B for non-residential. What you've got there essentially is the maximum FARs, not the base, nothing to do with bases, but the maximum FARs that you get for non-residential versus residential are very, very small. So the property values there are based on the much higher, 3 and 5 times higher residential densities that those properties will yield. And so the property values there are based on being able to build residential. Non-residential is not feasible based on the current FARs in those districts unless you've got something really strange going on. So what we did of all that is that basically we said, you know what, those properties, we don't have any direction to change those FARs for the non-residential uses for office in the old Bellevue district. So in that particular case, if somebody wanted to do office there, for whatever reason, there could be a reason somebody wants to do office. Mixed use, you're okay, because if more than 50% is residential, it counts as residential building, even mixed use. But if you want to do a straight office project there, you can do it. If it makes sense for whatever reason, you don't have to participate in the amenity incentive system because it doesn't make sense. And so we set the new base, based on this kind of analysis, set the new base at the same as the max. So you don't, it's not applicable for the incentive system.
Very interesting. Commissioner Lane, please, yeah.
Isn't this really sort of illustrating the impact of the commercial penalty and the FAR differential between the residential and commercial?
This is at the extreme. That's what this does. And you have this extreme, really, in the perimeter. For very deliberate reasons, when the perimeter was adopted back in the mid-80s, I think, it was considered that the perimeter, which are the edges of downtown, where you're scraping up against residential neighborhoods on all sides, the better transition there was a residential use. And so I think quite very deliberately at that time, the conclusion was that a better transition, a more graceful transition with those adjoining residential neighborhoods was the residential use. The extreme of this is in the perimeter. And Old Bellevue is all set in perimeter A and perimeter B.
Well, my observation when I look at the report and then seeing it up here is nice. It'd be great, by the way, to get that PowerPoint. This is really nice and very fine work. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. The one that stood up then and stands out now, like seeing it up on the big screen, so to speak, that was also the downtown mixed use, which I think is one of the areas that has been sort of by stakeholders, the BDA and others, for a long time identified as like, you know, that this the office penalty or the commercial penalty or whatever you want to call it is really driving or stalling, if you will, development or redevelopment in that area. And I think if you look, it's encouraging to see on the right hand with the new basin high that, you know, some of that change is obviously not in the old Bellevue for the reasons that you explained, Mr. Stroh, but it meaningfully changes for the downtown mixed use and even some of the other zoning categories. So just...
Well, that's a great segue to the next slide, honestly, because I can tell you, we tried to be as thoughtful about this as we could think to be, because we knew this was such a sensitive topic, and so where things didn't seem to make sense at that 85% rule, there are adjustments made higher to make more of the prototypes work, so we tried to find that sweet spot here, and what Commissioner Lang was just mentioning was for the MU non-residential, the conclusion was there that, and you can see a whole range of things tested there, but the conclusion was there that it was appropriate to adjust the new base higher so that you had more of the prototypes performing as they were intended to perform and going into the feasibility range. So that's
big step.
Can I ask why, in light of the fact that the CAC unanimously recommended removing the FAR differential there, that that wasn't tested and that's not what's being carried through here?
So the recommendation from the CAC was to increase, and what we talked about with the commission in this process, was to increase building heights in the MU, and the maximum FAR is the maximum building heights in the MU for non-residential to 200 feet, which is they are for residential today, and FAR 5, which is what they are for residential today. We still had to find the right base. So what happens is if you increase the base to the same it is for residential, then you turn the table so much that office will consistently outcompete for the land in the MU. So it's trying to, some of this has to do with trying to find the right place to settle within that legacy of what we're working from. One of the questions that ULI commented on, that they were asked to comment on, was with some of the equalization between residential and non-residential that's going on based on the CAC recommendations and the process to date, the council was concerned that it actually would turn things on their head and all of a sudden we would no longer have a residential market downtown. So the ULI was asked to comment on that, and they said they think that there's enough changes going on here that it will actually affect the market in a way that actually we'll see some shifting and somewhat less residential developed as we try to even things out. So trying to find that sweet spot of evening things out without killing the residential market. So there's a lot of interesting balancing stuff going on here, but ULI did comment on that question that the council had posed, I think getting at the point. So in the case of MU, non-residential, an additional adjustment in the base to try to get more of the prototypes working. The same thing had to be done in the OB and the old Bellevue A residential to get more of them working. So they had to be adjusted above the 85% level to the 90% level. So this kind of fine tuning was done in the modeling to try to make sure that, again, no cherry picking going on here, and then looking at individualized cases to make sure that the whole thing was thoughtful. And taking into account some things that are more unique to different districts. So then, from setting the new base, you get into the incentive analysis, and the question becomes, how do you value that? And you saw a sort of drawing a conclusion at the end there. You basically looked at, there's a range of remaining incentive capacity between the new base now and those new maximum FARs and heights. So trying to draw how much value that really converts into. What the consultant did on this was took all these different prototypes, generated essentially models based on building out to the base, building out to the max, figuring out that increment between base and max, and then ultimately for non-residential and residential by district, and ultimately taking in valuing that amount of square footage by increase in value in the residual land value that created. So, and then testing, what you really wind up, here's the added values that come out of all this. And you can see it by district, residential, non-residential. Now, an important point here, the amount available for an incentive zoning system, you might say that's the incremental value of that added FAR, that's bonus FAR between the new base and the new max, and you see pretty high numbers here in many cases, would not be appropriate for all that to be converted into the incentive zoning purchasing power, if you will. Because then it no longer would be an incentive. There's a risk to the developer, there's a profit margin, you need to make sure it's a real incentive, it needs to be calibrated to what our kind of the regional comparables, et cetera. So there are other factors that go into this. You can see in cases where overall averages of 85 and 60 and 57 and so forth, and then trying to come up with a number that seems to make sense across the board. We didn't set this exchange rate district by district. You can see there's sort of some variability there. But ultimately, taking out all that and condensing it down and then testing different potential exchange rates from $20 to $35 a square foot, trying to understand the likelihood that residential and non-residential developers would use it at different rates, and trying to find the sweet spot at $25 a square foot, which represents some portion of that lift. And then we did some comparisons to other systems within the region. So in South Lake Union, the affordable housing fee is $25 a square foot. Land values are lower. We have a very different system in Bellred. It's lower, but kind of there is some kind of market comps in here, comparing it to what a land itself is worth in terms of FAR. $25 seemed to be a reasonable number. And again, that was one of the things we asked the ULI panel about. Given all the effort to land these numbers, does this make sense? So then this final question about the value of additional height. particularly given that in many cases there is no additional FAR, there's no addition to the maximum FAR that goes with this height. So again, in a district like the O1 or the O2, there's additional height that's in the recommended package, but no additional FAR that goes with that. So we were trying to understand that. And Burke actually ran models at basically using and not using additional height. Again, trying to look at, is there value to the height alone? Now, also had to look at the additional cost for use, because it doesn't come free. That height goes with additional costs. There's a number of things you have to account for. And costs go up even as revenues can go up with the added height. So that was all part of the modeling here. And in the end, came up with several different options for how you could take the results of that analysis, and the numbers are also in the book here, but take the results of that analysis and different policy options that you would have. So if you exceed the base, in the first option, that additional height is only available if you exceed the base FAR. It's only if you're going to the bonus system. And the second one, you could say, second one really gets down to, cut to the chase, it gets down to adding on some dollar increment to use that additional height. So the FAR above the existing height, above what we now call the trigger height, would have some kind of, I don't know the right term for it, but there would be a premium placed on it above and beyond the $25 exchange rate. Or the final one is you could essentially find a different way to incorporate it into the system. And what was really proposed was essentially two different ways to work the value of the added height. One is if it's just kind of work the value of added height on its own, and then work the value of added height as just part of the bonus, automatically as part of the bonus system. Take whichever of those is greater. In any event, what that's really trying to get at is it's trying to get at double counting that value of height. And we got the same feedback from ULI, which is why they're really proposing this last option. Because we don't want to double count that value. In some cases, the only way you use that additional FAR is by using that additional height. So we want to make sure we're not double counting there. That wouldn't be fair. So that's what that ultimately came down to. So the Burke analysis was quite the consultant process. I think they did a really good job with a really tough assignment. Honestly, it was more complex than anybody. Certainly we thought, or the consultant, I think, thought we'd be getting into. I think it was a real honest effort to really try to be sensitive to understanding the economics of what these changes would do and try to capture that in a reasonable way. We wanted to have a peer review process of development professionals who really understood the market come in and kind of test whether this homework was on point or not. So the Urban Land Institute panel was assembled for the purpose. As I said, this is very, very fresh. The panel met for the first time in a very, very intensive day-long session last week ago. And their task was essentially to review each of the key parts of this analysis. See if it met the council principles, see if, in fact, it was grounded in market realities, kind of see if it made sense. It's an independent review process, so we provide good solid information and then sit back and kind of wait and see what comes out of it. It was chaired by Al Levine, Al Levine, who's adjunct faculty at the Munstead Center, and had a variety, I think it was a very qualified panel of development professionals who took a look at this effort and were asked to, again, kind of ground truth the recommendations that came out of this. Is it consistent with the council principles and best practices? Do these numbers make sense? Are the exchange rates reasonable, and so forth? So these are the questions that were asked of the UI panel. And as I mentioned earlier, there were a couple of added-on questions when we were just talking about will there be some distortion of the market in terms of some of the changes going on, will the parking change result in somehow impacting how parking is handled? So those are the questions that were posed to the panel. Overall, this was fresh from today. Overall, the panel concluded that, and this is their slide, the objectives of revising the downtown system was met, but no plan is perfect, and we don't expect all stakeholders to be satisfied. They said we need to be updating this thing more frequently than once every 35 years, to say the least. And there were a number of caveats. We've already talked about a few of them. I think the caveats are really important. We hadn't planned to go through each of the ULI slides. We're digesting these and can discuss these further, but there's some very important caveats in there, in the ULI findings. Overall, I think the results were quite favorable. They noted comments such as, well, you kind of set out to simplify the system. It's not necessarily simplified from what it is today. They wanted to make sure we recognize there's a significant cost to increasing height, and in many cases, the market's not going to support that. So you're not going to see every building in the core coming at 600 feet and use that additional increment of height, because that's a significant cost to do that. They acknowledged that we didn't do a start over on downtown zoning with this effort. There's a lot of legacy that's embedded. They kind of acknowledged that had we kind of started over and scraped the map clean and rethought things fundamentally, we probably would have done things differently. So we're working off a legacy system here, and they kind of acknowledged that, and we're carrying forward some of that existing framework as an important kind of element in thinking about all this. They noted some of the discussion we had earlier about we've made very limited adjustments to issues like parking, and asking whether we'd gone far enough in thinking about it. Their focus wasn't really on have we handled retail correctly, but it's something for us to look at in terms of observations they made, noting that our retail changes, we want to make sure that as we update the code, we're being sensitive about those things. Will the system really act as an incentive? Well, they said it can be very property specific. It can depend on a number of factors, and including where we are in the development cycle. There's some comments about South Lake Union and how slow, when that system was updated, it was for development to really use it. But then when things picked up in the development cycle, things changed. So again, we're processing the feedback we got from ULI. Very, very valuable to go through that peer review process. We're looking at that as part of our next steps, that we really review those findings in detail. Additional work that's going on right now, because there are pieces of this that you haven't seen yet and that you should see actually in a couple weeks in our next installment with the commission. One of the things that ULI commented on is that we haven't really seen the final ratios come out of this. We have the exchange rates, that's a key part. But ultimately, that conversion into each of the amenities, the cost of those amenities, and then taking that exchange rate and converting that into the bonus square feet. We haven't seen it yet, so we're developing that. The principles in this effort talked about tailoring amenities to promote neighborhood identity. So that's a piece. The existing code essentially takes and sets different ratios by zoning district. What we're looking at is setting different ratios by zoning district and by neighborhood. So there can be some modifications to those by neighborhood in order to capture some of that neighborhood identity that the CAC talks so much about. We need to clarify the height valuation. We did get some direction on that or some thoughts on that from ULI. The fee in lieu provisions, ULI also talked about this. It's going to be important for us. Part of the principles that we should have a fee in lieu and want to know what that fee in lieu would be and how we're going to handle that. The fee in lieu, of course, means if you don't build the amenity as part of the project, paying some amount that essentially becomes an ability to capture that in the pool so it can be built. But how are we going to handle that? And then provisions for periodic review that we need to develop and get more clear about what's the appropriate way to make sure this thing doesn't get so out of hand. And the balance point in that is recognizing that development needs a level playing field. They need to understand what the playing field is. Can't go kind of willy-nilly adjusting the system every couple of years because nobody knows what the rules are or what how to value a given land transaction or a planning for development that can take multiple years to do. So we need a way to update the system, keep the system up to date, that recognizes the need for a level of stability as well. So that's what we have to develop as we think about the making sure this thing stays reasonably up to date. So that's upcoming work, and you'll see a lot of that at the next installment, when we're before the commission. Emil, do you have any other concluding?
No, I think we're just can entertain any questions from the commission before we move on to the next segment of the.
I want to say thank you, Dan, for the very detailed walkthrough. I do want to commend you and the staff team for the initiative in leading with the panel and the feedback, and obviously, you know, it's very early in terms of your own perusal. But I think maybe there's a couple of things in there we certainly want to follow up on. But I do certainly appreciate the openness and the willingness to get the feedback and work on it. Want to quickly go on? Any questions, comments on this one?
Just not necessarily data. So the panelists, are they all from right here in the Seattle area? Or do we have panelists that have maybe perspectives from the outside that they're bringing into the Bellevue area?
Yeah, great question. So. Interesting trying to find panelists for this because we're trying to find panelists that are very familiar with our regional market but are not doing development work in downtown Bellevue. And more over the years, developers who are working across the lake are working in downtown Bellevue because Bellevue is a great market. So ULI really tried to find mostly panelists from this region who understood this region. A lot of working in Seattle but for whatever reason are not working in Bellevue. There's one exception who's the economist, the chief economist for the team is out of Portland. So this was essentially a regional panel, and typically it would come from Puget Sound region for this kind of panel, but we did have the need to get that perspective on the economic side was also advanced by the Portland economist.
Okay, thanks.
And Jerry Johnson.
Any other comments, questions? If not, again, thank you very much. Back to Mr. King.
Okay. So our next segment tonight is our continuing review of the draft land use code amendment. I'm going to hand it over to Trish, and she's going to walk through a number of items that we're continuing to entertain refinements on from the commission as we ready for a public hearing.
So one of the things that I wanted to tell you all is next week you'll be getting another draft of the land use code amendments. And what we've done is we've tried to build in the feedback that we've received so far. The code that you have in your packet is going to change some. And I wanted to just let you know that this next draft that you'll receive will be much more refined. And we were listening to your feedback as well as the feedback that we're getting from stakeholders and responding to that. So as you recall, last time we went through all the things, sort of the chaff that we could get rid of. So the things like the early wins and the things that weren't changing. And we ended up with the substantial code changes that we needed to go through, which ended up being the dimensional charts, the green sustainability factor, the design guidelines, and the big lift, which is the FAR and the amenity incentive system, which we'll be going through in the next few sessions. So those are that's the big body of work that we have left to do. One of the first things that we heard from everyone was that the tower separation, the 80 feet for multiple buildings on the same lot, was something that we needed to take a look at. We're looking at tower setbacks for single lots, and what that means is the setback that's up above 40 feet and is measured from the interior property line. There was also some feedback that there's difficulty for those sites that are small, so we're looking at flexibility for that. We're also building in a departure for that tower separation and for the setbacks. So we'll be looking for that, and that will be in your packet. It'll be in 060, that's in the dimensional charts. The next one is the perimeter overlay step back, which is measured from the facade. And we are refining that to ensure consistency with existing code requirements. And in fact, the step back will not just be in the perimeter overlay, but will also be in on, let's see, 8th, 4th, and Bellevue Way. So be looking for that. And the reason we'll actually have that on a map for you in the code, because of the way that it's configured, it goes through many zones, and it's just easier to have a map so that you can look for that in your code. The trigger for additional height, we've also been working on. What we had been working on was the 10% reduction in floor plate above the trigger height. We're working on getting the averaging to work so that you have some more slender towers and you can average that down to 80 feet. The outdoor plaza that would be required would be 10% of the project limit. There was some feedback that should be, there should be a sliding scale related to the height over. So the person who builds the building that's just 1 foot over the trigger height probably shouldn't have to provide as much as someone, or as much outdoor plaza as someone who goes 100 feet over the trigger. So the request was for a sliding scale, and we're looking at that. That one has become more complex than we originally thought. And we're also looking at writing a departure for that one. It would be an administrative departure. So the green sustainability factor has, you've seen that in your code. There are some refinements that we've been working on. One is the addition of a tree list that ensures consistency in review, and that's specifically for the size of the tree, because that's how it's calculated, how you get your points for the green sustainability factor. The bonuses for landmark and evergreen trees are written more clearly so that it's clear that it's a bonus. And then the bike parking has to be publicly accessible, and you will see that in your new code provisions. And in all of these, I've put the old, meaning the ones that are in your packet tonight, I put the code sites in there for you and the pages.
That's a good question. So, thank you. On the visibility for public areas, do we also have any language around lighting for the bike parking?
That's a good question. We have we have design guidelines for lighting, and I would have to go back and look specifically as far as the bike parking is concerned, but I'll take a look at that. I've got a list of to-do items. So that's one I'll have to look at.
Thank you.
We do have it for pedestrian. But I'll take a look at that and see what we've got. and Ben. Who else we've got? Okay, so the other changes that we'll be looking at and you should be sort of paying attention to is you will have the design guideline changes, and there will be some minor changes to that. The FAR and amenity system changes that we'll be working on. The pedestrian corridor super bonus. As you know, we didn't change the pedestrian corridor provision simply because the Grand Connection is coming along and they'll be working on that pretty intensively. But we need to put the super bonus back in, and it was not intended to be deleted. The other thing that's coming in that I think will be really helpful is that we'll be putting the graphics into the code so that you can see for the first time the graphics that we've been working on. And the visuals are really helpful for understanding what's going on. And then we'll have the conformance amendments, which help this code fit in with the rest of the code. There are other small changes on our to-do list that we'll be putting into, and it will be much closer to the final product. And what we're hoping is that we will have a code that's ready for a public hearing next time around. So that's where we are. February 8th is when we will be providing you that new code. We hope to get it out on February 1st, and then we'll be moving toward public hearing. Neil, do you have more to say?
No, we're just wanting to continue to support the commission to get you to the point where you're comfortable having a draft land use code that you're wanting to set the formal public hearing for. So there's typically about a 3-week period between the commission gives us direction and when we can actually hold the hearing based on noticing requirements. So we'll be incorporating the changes that Tricia talked about, and also adding quite a bit of new information, including graphics, incentive system provisions to the code. And we'll be doing that in a stripe underline version so you can easily track what the first draft was on November 17th versus what this additional information is.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
And then as it goes, I believe as the plan is when it actually goes out with the notice, are we going to, I don't know that we'll be keeping the stripe underline in there, which is this is our final ready to go for public hearing. But we'll have the graphics in, which will be nice.
And we'll continue to have that annotated table of contents that accompanies the code, because we found that's a useful tool for the commission and public to kind of track how the code is modified.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you. Any questions, comments around the please, yes.
So my apologies. I missed a bit of a couple of meetings, but I do have some comments going back to some of the procedural things and some of the other aspects of the draft land use code that don't have anything to do with dimensional charts or any of the rest of it. And I don't know, I've read all the meeting minutes, it doesn't look like any of that has been discussed, and I just want to know if there's going to be an opportunity to discuss those aspects. These are things like definitions and organization, the departure provisions, the master plan development, the quote-unquote legislative, what do we use?
Departures.
Legislative stuff. There's some provisions in there that I thought would be appropriate to have some conversation about.
We were going to be doing some clarifying language on that. I think it was touched upon perhaps in a meeting where you're absent on it. So if it makes sense, maybe at the next commission meeting where we do have our revised language, then you can have the current version and have a discussion on those sections with you.
Thank you. And I don't ever mean to move the commission backward, but yep. I didn't catch any of it in reviewing the meeting minutes. And thank you.
Thank you. Back to you.
If there's no other questions, that concludes our study session item.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I think we're on track for timing as well, so really appreciate the work and the energy. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
So moving on, we were going to have a session on the post-retreat prototype, but I think given attendance today, I would propose that we move this out unless there's strong input. Please.
So, Chair, I was just going to, well, 2 points, I guess. Number one, I thought we had talked about, even if people miss the meetings on this, we have to move forward, otherwise we could keep laboring it, because we'll never have all seven of us here. And the other suggestion, I know we approved the agenda, but because this is a piece that the public may or may not be interested, I was going to suggest perhaps we move public comment up, and perhaps do that now for the public that's here, and then we could maybe move to that, so.
That's fine feedback, absolutely, yes, Ms. Lechelle.
So I appreciate Commissioner Hillhorst's comments, and I would support moving the public comment period forward, but I was one of the commissioners that was unable to attend the retreat, as you know, and you and Mr. Cullen were kind enough to spend more of your time to sort of educate me about some of the things that I missed. I studied the minutes from the last meeting about the topic of the prototype, and I did appreciate Mr. Cullen's email, but for me, given that one, I was not at the retreat, and two, the significance of some of the things that are being proposed or would be discussed tonight in that agenda item on the, what do we call it, the Planning Commission prototype, I would not be in favor of having that discussion when at best we have three of the commissioners that were actually present that evening. And so I agree with Commissioner Hillhorst's observation, and also I believe it was Commissioner Barksdale may have actually said that in the last meeting, that if we wait until everybody's here, it may never happen. At the same time, having this conversation with really only three people that were present, I don't think that is appropriate. So, and it's with all due respect to me and all my wonderful contributions. So,
thank you, sir.
So I would support a motion to amend the agenda at this point to basically strike that item and move forward with public comment.
We have a second.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
So I think
we opposed.
All right. We will then take the majority, and we will sell it. But I do have to agree with Commissioner Lang. I think at this point it looks unlikely we will have all seven commissioners in the near future. And so, Mr. Cullen, we may have to go back to the drawing board as to how we move that forward. Also, want to respect the public's time. I think this is one reason why maybe we have to have a plan B in terms of how we make progress on numbers. So we'll take it offline. So with that, then we move on to public comment, as Commissioner Hillhorst had asked for. So we'll open it up for comments. Yes, sir.
Yes.
Welcome
Chuck,
back.
Get out of here. You guys must value your time or something.
All right, well, I'll be brief. I'll be quick. I'll try. Okay, Paige, there's a specific comment that I keep hearing from staff that I can't bear to hear any longer. There's no cherry picking going on here. Why does that need to be said? It leads me to believe that someone needs to check to see if there's cherry picking. And I can do it while you guys are talking. So you don't have to, I don't know if you guys have this, but this is the supporting documentation for the Burke analysis. You guys have the Burke analysis. I don't know why we didn't go over it in more detail here. But one of the cherry-picking parts that will be found in these numbers, it's somewhat easy, because it says on page 30 of the report, there's a third variable, assigning some portion of a building's lower floors to above-ground structure parking is also available. Meaning available to make these pro forma prototypes work. This has the effect of reducing the average cost of parking, since these stalls are 65 to 70% of the cost of underground space. While reducing development costs in this way can increase residual land value, it can also move in the other direction. Using some of the allowable building height for parking can result in a lower overall income potential, particularly if the project is in a zone with limited building heights. This fourth line down on the first pages of all this detailed work says above ground parking, gross square feet. I go through all the prototypes in the first 13 or so pages here. 54 out of the 84 of the prototypes are using above ground parking to be able to pencil, to make the prototype work feasible, right? That's 64%. So they're artificially saying 64% of the projects in the future for the next 35 years should have, will have, and need to have above ground parking. To me, that's not the livable environment that we're trying to achieve here. There's a reason we don't see a bunch of above ground parking garages today. There's more of them in Seattle, I think, than are over here. I don't know the specific reason. I'm comparing the two land use codes as to why that might be. It is cheaper. It would make things easier. But is it right? I don't know. But that's just a level of detail that needs to be gone through. I've provided a cheat sheet in my comments that you'll see there, so you guys don't have to go through it like I just did, counting numbers. So use my cheat sheet. Ask staff the same questions, because they're not going to answer my questions, but they will answer you guys if you ask my questions. Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, actually, no. One more point. The new system favors office development. That's stated in the ULI analysis. I know what you were saying about the commercial scale as previously, but now it feels like it's perhaps tipping the other direction, and that's all I'll say. Look into that one further, too. Okay.
If I could just ask you then on that one, then is it your perspective that it should tilt the other way, or do you have a point of view?
I think 50-50 is the best mix we can hope for, but it's probably near impossible for this process to deliver on that objective, because it's pretty precise and extreme calibration, as you can see going on with all these numbers. But like in some neighborhoods, like Old Bellevue, for instance, office use is discouraged, like 1.0 FAR. Nobody would ever build it. It's a one-story building over the whole site's square footage. So it's not feasible intentionally by design. But I've asked myself recently, why is that? We heard tonight from Mr. Stroh that the reason is it's not good to have office next to a residential surrounding perimeter neighborhoods. I kind of challenge that in my mind, because I live in those residential surrounding perimeter neighborhoods. And if there's residents and tall apartment buildings living next door to my two-story condo building in the perimeter, outside the perimeter, we're all home at the same time. Meaning we're all trying to shop and eat and park all at the same time. So you get congestion on the streets. You get lack of parking supply. If there's a mix of uses, like say office in the perimeter, like Old Bellevue, then the people will leave at night. So that office user, I could take their parking spot when they're gone. And that's the kind of mix, you know, the day and night use that I think is quintessential to not promote any type in any district. Right now we are clearly picking and choosing which districts should get certain uses, and just doesn't feel that like that's the right thing. Let the market determine. Let the neighborhoods determine. Let's not force feed it. So, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Phil McBride. I know you're thinking, oh, no, not again. But yeah, again. We're my partner's going to queue up a slide. Uh-oh.
Oh,
thanks. So he's going to queue up a slide. And while he does that, I just wanted to point out something.
Could you introduce yourself?
Sure. Phil McBride, 11040 Main Street. So we're on the north side of Main Street. And it just while he's queuing this up, he's going to spend, Andrew's going to spend most of the time talking. But I want to just highlight for the council that, on the southeast side at the corner, the intersection of 112th and Main, picture that. We got light rail on one corner. We've got the red line on another.
290 feet elevation. On the other corner is our property, 70 feet. And on the other corner is the Sheraton, I think, what, 240, something like that. So we're trying to understand from, you know, how is it that, how does that happen? How does that happen? We've got, surrounding us is a light rail station, 290 feet on one corner, 250 on the other, and we've got 70. And it's the zoning, you know, so that, Andrew's way more articulate with the zoning and what the issues are, and
just laser pointer.
Aaron had asked a question that we partly answered and didn't give you the full answer. Part of it is that we've got the A and the B overlay. We've got, for example, we've got one parcel that straddles both. We want to put commercial in the front, residential in the back, and the way the code is written is just not functioning for us. We're not arguing about the height. I mean, that's not it. It's just how do we get. I'm going to let Andrew take it.
So I was busy and I didn't hear as much. My name is Andrew Miller. I'm at BDR, 11100 Main Street, the corner of 112 and Main. This property right here. And what Phil was just talking about was East Main CAC, talking about this proud building on the corner, Sheraton on the corner here, and here we are, a very diminished property. So earlier, Mike Caterman said East Main Stationary Plane CAC was done. It's done. It's ready to be handed off. I think we all want a 100-year solution. And so here we are. Why are we not joining the East Main portion of downtown with the East Main Stationary Planning area, the OLB area? It's like they're throwing out half a donut and not finishing it off. Imagine if we'd done that in Spring District and you took the station and you did just the west side and then said, we'll do the east side some other time. That project never would have seen the light of day. And as a side note, that station, it's dense around the station and then it peels off. So stepping back, taking our project out, I'm not even going to show it right now, what would you design if you started from scratch? And this is the first property you've got to it. You've got off the train. It's the very first downtown project. So what you would want around that station, high density, closest to the station, and then going off to low density. You'd want mixed use. You'd want residential office. You'd want an inviting front door to downtown, maybe a grand stair. You'd want it to be open to the public, and you'd want a first-class project. And I think, switching to the end, wherever our project is, I think that sort of encapsulates what you would do if you started from scratch. And oddly enough, that's how we approach this project. The reason I bring this up, I think that this meets the criteria of what we're looking for on the front door downtown way better than that. But right now, the code leads us that direction. And Matt Roy, who had to leave, gave Commissioner Lang half an answer. And he felt bad afterwards. This is our time to fix it. There are two problems with this thing. One is we have 70 feet here. And what he said was, this use is limited, really, not limited, but really this use is sort of dedicated residential. Back in May, the Planning Commission said, you know what? Form counts, not function. So who cares what's in that building? The form is the important part. The other problem we have, which he didn't say and he feels bad about it, is that this whole thing is all based on a blended FAR over a single project. Right now, the code says this is one project and this is another. We say, crud, that's our property, and why can't we just consider it a single project or a single building, and that's our problem. So right now, we've completely, on purpose, diminished the FAR here. That we're given 5, that's not even 2. But what we did is we pushed all the FAR away from Maine to be respectful of the old patterns, and we pushed it all into that tower. But there's no code that allows us to do that. And so, all that aside, I think this is the better project. It's also the more expensive one. And I think that the code and the incentives should make this the more attractive option. But right now, what we need most from Planning Commission is to ask you to ask staff to make this project a reality. And the code doesn't do it, but only you can do it. Staff's overloaded. They're not going to look at it on their own. Only you can have them do it. Thank you.
Any questions, Commissioner Lane?
Well, I guess
I'm afraid this
could be. I don't want another half answer.
No more alternative facts, gentlemen. The sort of funny, I mean, these are, so going to the council principles, this is more really a comment than a question. I mean, the problem is if you go to the council principles and you look at it, one of them is like, let's not have unintended consequences. And so what we have here is sort of an unintended consequence of one, parcel ownership and parcel configuration, and two, these AB districts. I think one of the things, and this kind of goes back to the issue that I was raising with Mr. King earlier about just where we are in terms of our discussion. These are the types of things that I think that are should be resolvable through the flexibility that the community has expressed for 4 years about what they'd like to see. And so, you know, since we have Ms. Barker here, I would say again, you know, if you look at some of the thoughtfulness that both the Fortin Group put into what they have proposed, as well as the thoughtfulness that the CAC put in looking at that portion of downtown and the problem of the deep B, and if you look at a site like this, and this is kind of, you know, not coincidentally another corner that sort of suffers in a different way, but in a similar way from the same problem, is so what procedurally would be a good way to deal with this? Well, like, is this something that maybe if there was something procedurally that talked about, like, well, you could do like a development agreement. We have this concept in the code now that talks about like a master plan. So maybe, you know, this is something that can be tweaked through the master plan portion of the proposed downtown code that would allow for, that basically says, listen, if you've got one master plan site, even if it's sort of cobbled together between multiple parcels and multiple zones or multiple overlays or whatever, if at the end of the day you don't exceed the maximum height anywhere and you don't exceed the maximum FAR that would be allowed within that, in other words, your density stays the same, just how you move the lumps of clay around, then we're willing to let you do that. And so I don't understand, you know, there, and I'll use this one as a final, like, cliche. Like, there, you know, we've all heard, like, the old saying, the law is an ass, right? And this is the idea that the law sometimes compels an illogical result or potentially even an unjust result. And so if we get into a situation where we are unable to achieve something that is desirable because of a very sort of orthodox adherence to the law, maybe we might want to look at something in the code that would ensure that there's the flexibility that would allow this sort of moving things around without, you know, effectively spot zoning the site. That's where I get concerned, is anytime we get into a discussion like this where what it looks like is somebody's coming in saying, well, you know, let's just all kind of wink and nod and, you know, do this and do that and just kind of let us have a little bit more or have a little bit something different. I don't really see that as this. And I didn't see that with the Fortin Group's proposal either. And they were willing to, you know, put their money where their mouth is, the Fortin Group, in terms of saying, we'll commit to a process that requires us to do a development agreement or something else that actually contractually locks us in. So this is a really long way of trying to make these guys want to end the meeting, but a really long way of saying it, but, you know, I think that we could achieve something, but the way to achieve that is probably going to be looking at some of those procedural aspects of the code.
That's fair enough. I just, for the record, I don't want to acknowledge, you made a very cogent argument. I think it's a very logical argument, and certainly I believe that would be a good outcome. But we will have to work through the process, obviously, and that's something I think, you know, we'll follow up again. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
There was one more person, I think, who had raised their hand. If they are still here, if not,
thank you.
Yeah, Well, we have lost the person. All right, we'll move on then. Do we, I guess so, we have the draft finished already. Let's give it back to you, Mr. Cullen, for a minute.
Yes. What you have...
I was almost sure we were going to adjourn, but then I forgot about
it. Yes, no minutes. Necessary part of it. The December 7th ones were approved by the Planning Commission on January the 11th with some minor amendments, and I put those into it. The chair's got those to sign. And we have draft minutes for January 11th that are up for your consideration tonight.
So do we have any comments, feedback, any revisions, edits?
I move to approve the January 11th, 2017 minutes.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Well, there we go. We have the minutes approved.
And before you adjourn, if I may, the mayor did send an email in just as the meeting was starting, so he just said he was in Lake Hills at a meeting with some people on a neighborhood issue, and this will go on for some time, so probably will not make it to the Planning Commission. Please tell the commissioners that I read the minutes and package and appreciate the work being done. And I can report back to him when he says, I hope they can get through the downtown livability on time. I would say they were ahead of schedule. And he looks forward to your eventual review of the prototype and getting your comments. He'll be the final leg of review after the staff's reviewed it, and then the Planning Commission, and then it'll be the City Council liaison.
Thank you for the update, and please tell them we will make sure we get the livability things done.
Absolutely.
We will get it done, yes. All right, so do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second? Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, well, there we go. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Chair David Oss.
I told you, we'll stay on 5 minutes.
You read a tight ship, so we are in your debt.
Thank you for that, my friend.
Like a phone word. I'm going to go to the white.
She's still.